Well, Happy New Year, everyone. Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Bob Hoy. He's advised institutional clients for three decades, editor-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. That's all one word. Happy New Year, Bob Hoy.
Well, the best to you. We will be enjoying it this evening. I guess you will be too.
It's been really a momentous year. I mean, we have seen just so much volatility. What do you see for 2016?
Well, more of the same, continuing. We're in extraordinary times. You know, every throughout all of history, the end of a great boom has always been exciting. It's always been volatile and choppy as the transition comes in. But you've never had one before where the authorities, central bankers and treasury departments, have been so trying so hard to keep a violent financial bubble going. And it's amazing that they even try. They live in a strange world, these central bankers. And one of the ironies is that I think that the Federal Reserve cannot raise the short rate because there's so much money sloshing around out there and there is so much risk out there that a lot of people, the safe money always parks in the most liquid item. Like, return doesn't matter. So a liquid item, perhaps one of the most, is the short-dated instruments in the U.S., treasury bills, and gold. So, but you've got here, so I don't think the market's allowing them to raise rates, but this doesn't mean that other interest rates will not go up. So, and we look back on the end of the great boom bubbles in 1873 and in 1929 and 2007, the senior central bank, the record there has been on the major changes in interest rates, the market rates, like T-bill rates or longer out, 1 year maybe out to notes, changed, and then the central bank followed. So let's just take a look at this year. Long-dated treasuries set their lowest yield at the end of January, and they've gone up in yield since. And now, in the last 3 months, the debate about the Fed raising the rate was intense and absolutely absurd, because whatever they did would be after market rates of interest increased. So some people will say that, oh, the market rates increased recently because the Fed was talking about raising rates. But you look at it, long-dated treasuries have been increasing in yield since January, February. And you have the case of, let's take junk bonds, triple C junk bonds. They set their low yield in June of 2014, and that was around 8%, and now they're around 18%. So what's the Fed got to do with that? Absolutely nothing. It was a change in the perception of risk, so the market forces have adjusted. But one of the things that's coming out at this year end is that many of the hedge funds did not have a good year. There were some market changes they didn't expect, a number of analysts, but we want to look at what we had going into last January. We were looking for what we called the rotation, where some of the depressed commodity sectors would rally, and they might rally out till around April or May, and they did. And in the case of gold, we've advised to accumulate a bit, not much, because it is all very precarious out there. Then the other one was the base metal prices. That was part of the rotation, and when they reached their peak in the spring, and then also to get out of the base metal mining stocks. On the credit market side, we had the credit spreads narrowing into around June, and they did. And then once that seasonal turn had started, the trend, the chart of credit spreads, and this was using the triple B or the triple C relative to treasuries, when that widening, if it had it broke out at certain levels in July, it would trigger off footer breaks in commodities and in the stock market. And what it did do was trigger off the crash in the Shanghai market. There was no policy change there. It was just excessive speculation. And then the credit spreads turning. And it's always, I think, a little limiting with equity guys to sort of look at management or look at the general equity market and look at what the Fed's doing and try and figure out where stocks are going to go based on that, when underneath it all, it's the credit spreads that drive it. So that happened. And then we want to also mention on crude oil. This one goes back to the spring of 2014. When crude, we expected again its seasonal rally up until around May or June, and that's when it rallied up to 107. And I had an interview with one of the big two weekly magazines in Canada, and the writer there, Jason Kirby, was pretty bold because he put it out that we were looking for the rally to go up to around June, and then when it turned down because of the potential change in credit spreads, it could be a severe bear market for crude oil. And we had used it compared to in gold prices because it was the best way to look at it in the 1930s depression. So our view was that relative to gold, crude oil could fall to one-third of the high or to one-quarter. And then in translating that to actually dollar prices, yeah, we did 37 and 27. So the initial target was 37, which we've met. It got into the low end of the 35. But we still have the other target out there at 27. And it may not, well, we may not reach it in the next 3 or 4 months, but it could reach it later on next year. So, and this will be a, it's, when crude first started to go down, the conventional view was that, oh, great, this will bring gasoline prices down, and that'll put more money in the hands of the consumer. And, yeah, it's a theory, but the problem is that when crude oil goes down, as with other commodities going down, it signals a weaker economy. So then you have a weaker economy, you got poor employment and stuff like that, so it's not really a blessing. And then especially when you've got all those sovereign wealth funds who are, you know, lapping up all of the money coming in from high-priced crude and investing in everything else. So it's all in a contraction. So there's an old saying on long post-bubble depressions that with weaker grain prices, then the farmers are forced to plant from fence post to fence post because poor prices means they got to have more of the stuff to try and eke out a living. And we've quipped that this is the same thing in crude oil, that the oil people are, well, drilling from fence post to fence post. And the weaker the prices are, those that can produce economically are going to keep ramping up production as best they can. So crude oil has taken on a decline to a new price regime. And as I say, then after perhaps a rally into the first quarter for crude, continues on down. The feature of every post-bubble contraction, and on this one, the blowout in 2007 was a classic bubble, like 1929 or like 1873 or even as far back as 1825, that these contractions have lasted 20 to 25 years. Of course, interrupted by the usual business cycle, and in this case, the first business expansion out of a classic crash, which ended in 2009, and the bull market that went with it, they're both now very mature, and we saw the Chicago PMI yesterday, and it's looking very weak, but at any rate, I think that the next leg down could be visible, oh, say, after March or April, and it's going to be severe. So then with it is likely to be another phase of strengthening in the U.S. dollar, because years ago when I did the research, the obvious thing was that in a post-bubble contraction, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most other currencies. And I think the mechanism behind it is that in the financial bubble, everybody wants, it was reaching for yield. And of course, a whole lot of countries and corporations end up getting money if you have most of the debt that was expanded, written, and due and payable in U.S. dollars in New York. There you go. And once the compulsion becomes servicing the debt into the financial center, which is New York. So all of that debt written in New York, due and payable in U.S. dollars, you can call it a short position. And if you call it a short position, it must be the biggest one in history. So this then is a puzzle. It's a puzzle for the central banker who really believes that depreciating the U.S. dollar is a wonderful benefit. And when they can't do it, they just get, you know, I guess it must be very frustrating to be a central banker these days.
Very true. But on the other hand, we have to keep in mind that it tends to be the herd that wakes up to all of these things that you're seeing 6 to 12 months in advance. It can take them a really long time. It can take the herd much longer to recognize the fact bull market is coming to a close. And after speaking with Martin Armstrong this week, the forecaster, he's forecasting as much as another 100% climb on the Dow that leads to a year 2000-like blow-off, which then culminates with the scenario you've just laid out. He thinks that the presidential year is going to be much stronger than people think, and then 2017 to 2020 leads to a grand down cycle unlike anything we've seen since 1929.
Oh, yeah. We will eventually have another severe bear market, like as even the establishment said in 2008, 2009, that it was the greatest collapse since the 1930s. Step one. Step two is that we've been on the first business cycle out of that. So it's sort of like 1937 or 38, which was a very dynamic stock market bounce out of that. So what I like to look at is, yes, there will be. As a matter of fact, I think the next phase of the contraction has already started, particularly in the credit markets. Like, you've got the yield for CCC junk bonds, which in June of around 8%. Now it's around 18%, trading there for the last week or so. And the high in 2009 was 45%. So once you get a trend going on widening credit spreads, or in this case what I was talking about is an increasing yield for lower grade stuff, that trend goes for a long ways. And so that's what will guide us as to the bubble feature. In the 70s, the big speculation was in commodities, real estate, wages, consumer prices. CPI went up to, 14%? And, of course, against that was the speculation and rising interest rates, where the long bond went up to 15%. Now, this is what the gold bugs have been hanging their hats on, was this relation to in silver and other commodities going up. The trick in that one was, that was 1980. 81 was high for the yield. And then commodities started to come down, and that's when I first started presenting to financial institutions. And they were all geared for it. They had finally figured out that it was the Fed that was causing inflation, and they were geared for that. But the point of view we took is what happened after the huge commodity inflation in 1920 crashed, and that crash then set up the bubble in financial assets. So the view in 1981 and 82 was, the quip was that I used was that no matter how much the Fed prints financial assets, stocks will outperform commodities. Well, that was impossible to accept at that time, and that indeed did happen. You've been in financial asset inflation then, with some couple of severe bear markets, you know, 2000 and after 2007. But we are still in an era of financial asset inflation, and that's chosen by the public. And it's not chosen by gold bugs or silver bugs. It's the public. The public decides. So the point, and it's a subtle one, Chris, is that the Federal Reserve, in order to be reckless, has to have a bid out there for something, and it has to be a speculative bid that is highly leveraged. And you've seen that in the low-grade bond markets. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's been a bloodbath there. There's no question.
Yeah, well, the crash has been, but the speculation, and also the speculation in euro yield with the German 10-year note getting down to 0.006 or something like that percent, that is like the equivalent of gold going to 10,000. So what's happening is it's, you're going to get a crash in these financial assets, the equivalent of when gold crashed after 1980, a long, lengthy crash.
I think one of the aspects that is so appealing to these discussions, in general, people are specialists. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the mythical Sherlock Holmes was a specialist, and he was proud of that. I'm not going to fill my mind with worthless information. I'm going to fill it with the pertinent information that's going to help me solve these cases. Okay. I'd like to discuss something that I've noticed just looking over the past several years since the 2000, you were referring to 2008 housing HGX index, and one can't help but notice a striking diamond pattern and reliable pattern, even more so than the head and shoulders. A novice would recognize it right away, regardless of the weekly, daily, or monthly periodicity. Over all of 2015, beginning around March, we can see another striking, albeit much smaller and tighter. We broke down 4 weeks ago, it started, and we've had a little bounce up to key, what was support, that now looks like resistance.
Yeah, but I think the big picture, Chris, is to where some people are looking for a huge bubble yet in stocks, is that the bubbles are elusive. We had a huge bubble in tangible things and commodities and wages in 1980. Then we've had a series of big financial bubbles, stocks, over the high techs in 2000. And what you have now is, and I want to really, I'm repeating it, Chris, is that we have had the same thing as the tech bubble in 2000, but in lower grade bonds. And as these go down, we're going to go into what I've been calling a bond revulsion. And it's not the revulsion that you had in the 1970s where yields went up because inflation was going up. It's going to be yields going up because of severe deflation, whereby most commodities are weak, and when they're weak, it indicates poor pricing power amongst most corporations. And if they haven't got pricing power, they're not making money, and they're having trouble servicing their debt. And then they may be investment grade, triple B, but the credit rating agencies, of course, are watching these like hawks, and they then will start marking down their agents. So it's a classic one, as old as the hills, that when you have a huge debt load, weakening commodities and weakening business is a disaster for servicing that debt. So I think that you've had the consumer price bubble and wages and commodities 1980. You've had a number of financial asset bubbles, equities, and now you have, in between 2008, you had a very vigorous commodity speculation, and crude got up to 147, and that's all changed now. So the last bubble has been in low-grade bonds, but it's also been in what could become low-grade bonds, and that's sovereign debt in Europe. It's been, I think that is going to be the dominant thing for next year, will be a huge adjustment in credit spreads widening, and most bond prices falling in price and yields going up. It'll be a grinder, and that then will put a lid on the ability to speculate in stocks. We have been in a period of time, a, a, tremendous experiment in authoritarian government. When were the periods of horrendous experiment in authoritarian government in the senior economy? The answer, 3rd century Rome, when it turned into a police state, and the 1600s, or the 1500s to the early 1600s, when the Catholic Church was turned into a police state, and in the 20th century, when you've seen the corruption in the United States now, which is the leading economy. 3rd century, 16th century, and 20th century. When was the period of chronic price inflation? The next question is, when was the chronic price inflation in the senior economy? I'm not talking about banana republics or Weimar republics. I'm talking about the senior economy. And the history shows the 3rd century with Rome, the 1500s, rampant price inflation, and then 20th century and still running. Okay, so then you go back to the two previous examples and you ask the question, how long did each one run? About 100 years. In the 3rd century, and then in about 310 or something, Constantine said, we're going to start doing the gold solidus, and then the inflation was over, and everything got quiet. So each one, it takes the bureaucracy about 100 years to spend all of the wealth that's accumulated and to go through, not only to spend that wealth, spend future wealth with debt, and then the public starts to wake up, and it says, what are these guys doing? Going back to the 3rd century, the state, the bureaucracy was running things, and it was, the head of it was called the genius of the emperor. Like, he could do no wrong. So then you get into the 1500s and early 1600s, it was the infallibility of the church. It could do no wrong. And what you have now, of course, is the infallibility of central bankers. It's the same thing as the genius of the emperor. So in each of the previous ones, the bureaucrats had screwed up so badly that the public took a look. It could happen on the election next year in the U.S. because it's the senior economy, but they've also been pushing that they can manage the climate. They can manage the temperature of the world. In the late 1700s, early 1800s, was spectacular, but it was not the concluding action that you saw at the end of the 1500s or the end of the 3rd century.
So you're talking about a sea change event that just topples whole continents.
Yeah.
So many of my top guests, reluctant but adamant, to point out that they just see the worst ahead.
Well, I think we could call this ending action, and who knows how many years it'll take, but we are at the ending action, and as I said, that this time the promoters in government have been pushing two fraudulent stories, two superstitions. One, that they can manage the economy. Two, that they can manage the temperature of the earth. An old saying from the old and dreadful Vancouver Stock Exchange, and it'll put the perspective of government ambition, it'll put government ambition in perspective, and that is the definition of a promotion. And it starts as, in the beginning, the promoter has the vision and the public has the money. And at the end of the promotion, the promoter has the money and the public has the vision. And at the moment, the public has the vision, and many economists do, that the economy can be managed. They also believe, many of them, too many do, that the temperature of the planet can be managed as well. So the public has the vision, and the governments have the money, and the promotion is now run its course.
Here, why don't you tell people more about the services you provide, please?
Yeah, we can be got, even find out about us at institutionaladvisors.com, or as I was surprised to discover a number of years ago, that when you just put in my name, Bob Hoye, H-O-Y-E, bang, it all comes up on Google. So, we welcome your interest, and we provide a trial basis, a free one, the same stuff that we send to institutions and mining companies and analysts and everything else, portfolio managers. And it's all the same research goes out, and you can try it for a while, maybe 5 weeks.
I want you to have a fantastic new year.
All the best to you, Chris, and to our listeners.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.